Okay, so what I want to talk about today is our traditional model of caterpillar-plant interactions are that caterpillars, in choosing host plant species or individuals, typically view them in terms of the nutritional content that they're likely to provide during development. And as we've known for a long time, plants as food are not such a great thing. They often have low nutritional content, typically less than 2% of dry weight of organic nitrogen, low concentrations of sodium, cellulose and lignins very difficult to digest. They're typically unpalatable and often toxic and are extremely highly defended, as many of the talks we've heard today and in other sessions. There's a pharmacopoeia of secondary compounds and phytotoxins, of course, that have prompted this idea that herbivores and plants are locked in a never ever escalating arms race of chemical the creation of novel chemicals and detoxification mechanisms within the herbivore lineages. And so for the last 50 years or so, this field's been dominated by the chemical coevolution paradigm that posits that most herbivores are highly specialized and feed on a single plant species or a few closely related species with similar plant chemistries, and plant toxins and insect detoxification mechanisms are then viewed as locked in a never-ending coevolutionary arms race. In this view, plant chemistry has been seen as the central force determining patterns of herbivore association and use. And probably some of the best examples of this come from Brian Farrell and Charlie Mitter's work on parallel diversification within milkweed and their milkweed beetles, in which we see closely related plant species being fed upon by closely related beetle species and that fit very well this sort of chemical coevolutionary paradigm. So you conclude from the last 50 years that obviously plant chemistry is important and appears to be a driving force in the evolution of host specialization in insect herbivores. But the only, my only caveat to that is not all insects are specialists. So we've really been driven in the ecological study of, and evolutionary study of this interaction by focusing a lot on specialists and not so much on generalists. And so there have been a few things put out in the literature, you know, recognizing that generalism and polyphagy is a difficult and a sliding scale. It's a continuum. Liz Bernays, in their famous paper in 1988, stated that most insect herbivores are relatively specific, feeding on only one or a few genera or a single plant family or subfamily, and stated that less than 10% of all phytophagous insects feed on plants in more than three plant families. So she actually went out on a limb and put a number there. My view as a forest ecologist looking at caterpillars in temperate forests in eastern North America is quite different. If you look around at many of the most common caterpillars we see in eastern temperate forests, the vast majority of them are amazingly polyphagous. So if you pick up Dave Wagner's amazing caterpillar book and start leafing through, what you see for a large number of the taxa, there's a long list of host plants, and that's certainly not exhaustive. Many of those are just the tip of the iceberg in terms of what they actually can be fed on. So this community that I was studying was dominated by generalists, and so this chemical coevolution paradigm didn't seem to fit very well with this kind of worldview. And to put some real data behind that, again, going to Canada, this is data for the Canadian Lepidoptera, which have been surveyed very well in their host plant use. And this is just a summing across species within several of Macrolepidopteran families, looking at the average number of plant families that they've been recorded as host plants in Canada. And you can see many of the families well exceed that three-family threshold that was sort of posited by Bernays and Graham. So the conclusion then is that, well, obviously not all insects are specialists. There's a lot of generalists that need study. And for a lot of these generalists, when you look at them in detail and how they actually perform on these alternative host plants, what we oftentimes see is that their preferences, what they're most commonly fed on, does not always or oftentimes does not match how actually they do on those plants. So if you just take this biotrophic view of the interaction, it's often it appears to be what are maladaptive feeding decisions when you actually rear them in captivity, just examining the nutritional content of these plants. And so in order to resolve, the most common way to resolve those problems is people always say, well, it must be something else. And so they often say, well, maybe it's the third trophic level. And so it opens up a world of possibilities when you add the third trophic level and thinking about all the different ways in which these herbivores can interact with these plants, including such ideas that, like we saw with Susan's talk, the caterpillars can be sequestering compounds from the plants that are then used in defense by natural enemies. And additionally, lots of interactions directly between the plants and the third trophic level with semiochemicals, and also potentially even selection by the third trophic level for things like perch diameters for birds and other things like that may supply, basically be a selective force in the evolution of of plant attraction or facilitation of natural enemy defenses as biotic defenses from the perspective of the plant. And this has really come to, these ideas have been percolating for a long time and have most recently been formalized as what's called the tritrophic niche concept in a really, really exciting and insightful paper by Michael Singer and John Steierman in Ecology Letters that really puts a lot of thought into thinking about the ecological relationships and their evolutionary outcomes. So it really reconciled the ecological and evolutionary views of adaptive divergence in insect herbivores and explicitly recognizes the direct and indirect effects of natural enemies on patterns of host association and use. And what they pointed out was that a more traditional biotrophic view of host-plant-mediated divergence requires, in its essence, trade-offs, demonstration of trade-offs in physiological performance on alternative hosts. In other words, when you adapt to a new host, you sort of lose the ability to resist or feed on the old host. And so that pattern of diversification we would expect to find as usually manifested as genetic costs of resistance at a population level. And that whole idea has actually received relatively weak and ambiguous support in the literature. So as a counterpoint to that, then they put out the tritrophic view that predicts that adaptive divergence due to ecological trade-offs can occur between their physiological performance of herbivores and their susceptibility to natural enemies. And there's a relatively small number of studies that have actually shown this, but they're continuing to grow, and so it's a lot of excitement about this idea. And just to review, what's meant here in terms of an ecological trade-off from the tritrophic point of view is if each of those dots on the graph is a particular host plant in the diet of a generalist herbivore, you can plot the fitness in the presence of enemies on the y-axis versus the fitness in the absence of enemies. And if there are trade-offs going on, what you might expect to see is some host plants might be good quality food plants but be kind of a dangerous place to be as a caterpillar, whereas others that have equal fitness overall are low quality in terms of nutrition but offer some degree of enemy-free space or protection against natural enemies. So this idea of enemy-free space has been implicated in host shifts in a number of studies, and the idea is that insect herbivores can incorporate a novel host plant into their diets by feeding on a plant that's often suboptimal in terms of quality. So that kind of shift in shifting onto an inferior host plant would only be promoted by natural selection if there are other fitness benefits of using the novel host, for example, increased protection from predators or parasitoids or enemy-free space. And just to give one recent example that we haven't published yet, but that a study that I've been doing with in collaboration with Martha Weiss and her students on the silver-spotted skipper, a very common legume-feeding butterfly, that if in where we work in the DC area, their native host plant there is black locust, Robinia pseudacacia, but they also are routinely encountered on kudzu and wisteria, which are two naturalized exotic host plants that have been introduced over the last 100 or 150 years. And the larvae of these skippers are routinely observed using all three hosts in the DC area. And so we first started to look to see, well, what do they actually prefer? We see them using all. So we did some flight trials in looking at female oviposition choices in these three host plants in flight cages. And what we found is that the kudzu and the native host were the most preferred, and wisteria was used occasionally but was not a very preferred host plant by most of the butterflies. And then we did some sort of a biotrophic assay by looking at, in the lab on this foliage, how do they actually perform on these alternative host plants, and we found the same pattern, that the native host plant was actually the best, kudzu was kind of intermediate, wisteria was the worst host plant in terms of the development time that it took the larvae to get through their instars. And so the question then was, well, why are they using wisteria at all? They don't seem to be choosing it very frequently and they don't do very well on it. So that required looking at this interaction in the field. So we did some paired trials using kudzu as sort of the control, comparing kudzu to Robinia and kudzu to wisteria. And the Robinia and kudzu, were about equal, but what we saw a difference was that the wisteria, which was the really poor plant, actually had about three times the survival rate of the larvae during these field trials, suggesting that there could be some degree of enemy-free space that's keeping it in the diet of this insect herbivore. So this is a relatively specialized interaction, And if enemy free space like this can promote diet expansions of specialists, my bigger question is, could it also act to maintain the broad diets of generalists? So what about generalists? Could it be playing a role? And there's a couple things that you need to show. So if enemies are going to have an influence on the diet breadth evolution of generalists, then it requires that patterns of enemy attack vary among host plants, a pattern that we really need to demonstrate more often. Herbivore traits must show evolutionary responses to natural enemies, and these ecological trade-offs that Singer and Stutterman have proposed between host plant quality and the risk of attack figure prominently, and those may act to maintain some of these suboptimal hosts in diet. So, for example, in Dave Wagner's caterpillar book, some of the hosts that they are recorded on, if we just test them on them, they might not do so well, but that's, again, only looking at it from a biotrophic point of view. If we include enemies and look at their actual performance in the field, that may explain some of some of the range in diet breadth and why some plants are still included. Alternatively, the effects of enemies could be very variable, and that's often what we see. And so there's this alternative idea that it could be unpredictability in enemy-free space on alternative host plants that could sort of promote a bet hedging kind of strategy from the point of view of these herbivores, where they're placing their eggs on alternative host plants because they're not knowing which ones are going to offer enemy-free space. And so it's sort of an evolutionary strategy that they could be using equally well. And to sort of formalize this, I put this into a model of thinking about how first and third trophic levels might influence host range evolution in polyphagous herbivores, because there wasn't anything else in the literature. So this is just my first stab at sort of a qualitative model. So on the left-hand column, if you look at it's just a qualitative measure of the amount of variance that's in fitness that's due to the host plant quality alone, just the biotrophic view. And then the right-hand column is the amount of variance in fitness among host plants that's due entirely to natural enemies. So in the first row, if you look, if plants are relatively equal in terms of nutritional quality, but we see a lot of variance in the levels of attack of enemies, we'd expect rapid specialization on the hosts that provide the greatest protection from natural enemies. Conversely, if variation in quality is high, but it's relatively equal in terms of their risk of attack from enemies, we'd expect, again, specialization on hosts providing the highest quality food resources. What gets interesting if they're both high or both low. So what this model proposes is that polyphagy could be maintained if the covariance between these two factors across host plants is negative, and if the fitness in the presence of enemies is basically equal or nearly so across host plants. That's the way we might expect polyphagy to be maintained. If the covariance is positive, then of course there'd be rapid specialization on the hosts with the greatest combined fitness if both variances are high, or slower rates of specialization if variances are low. And so what we really like to do is come up with systems to test this model. And the system that I'm working on currently is a community of co-occurring sympatric highly polyphagous caterpillars in the family Limacodidae. These are all temperate caterpillars. They all have their wonderful counterparts in the tropics as well. There's about 20 species that commonly occur on deciduous trees in sort of eastern forests. And they all have a lot of features that suggest that enemies have played a big role in their biology. So several of them, or many of them, have these urticating spines that are chemically and physically that enable them to be chemically and physically defended. They have very long development times. They have very cryptic feeding. So they've evolved their head, as Mark showed in his videos. Their feeding can actually be hidden underneath their prothorax because so there's very little movement even during feeding, which might be help against enemies. And some species have frass ejection to eliminate any potential chemical cues. So they're incredibly polyphagous, feeding on a wide variety of woody trees and shrubs. The larvae feed during mid to late summer and fall, and individual caterpillars are restricted to a single host plant during development. So unlike say the Arctiids that are running around eating a little of this and a little of that, these guys pretty much just stay on their host plant. So because they're actually more like plant parasites, we'd expect the full effect of feeding on a particular plant to be manifested. So selection by that plant ought to be quite strong. They take very long time to development. It's frustrating to rear them because it can take up to 90 days for an individual caterpillar to get through. That's an awful lot of changing leaves. The morphology and behavior appear to have been resulted from selection by enemies, and they experience very high mortality from enemies, especially parasitoids. The enemies that we've been looking at are a mix of generalist predators that are found on the foliage of these trees, and a bunch of mostly specialized parasitoids, many of which are actually turning out to be new species that haven't been described as we're doing a lot of rearing and many of which are very similar to the same ones that Janssen's rearing in Costa Rica. The same genera, actually, of the tachinids are found in both the temperates and the tropical systems. This is just a picture of some of the common ones. And so one of the questions, perhaps maybe differs my talk from some of the others, is I want to use some of these phylogenetic approaches to look at, to actually map enemy association and use onto these phylogenies. We've done a lot of looking at host plant association, which is important, but I think enemies also deserve a little bit of attention. And so luckily, Dave Wagner did some barcoding of the common temperate species to provide a neighbor joining tree based on CO1 data for all of our assemblage. And what you can see is that it's a couple of clades here that still need further support and phylogenetic inference. But there's one clade that appears to have these deciduous dorsal spines. They're not chemically defended. They don't appear to sting, but physically they have these deciduous spines that can be removed by predators when they take a bite. And then there's this large clade in the middle that I call the spiny clade, that's some combination of physical and chemical defenses, so tubercles and spines that are urticating for the most part. There's two species in this group, one of which that gradually loses its spine through development, and another in which the spines have been entirely lost except in the very first instar, so they'll figure in a second. And then there's a non-spiny clade of cryptic species as well. And what I did was look at attack by one of the most common parasitoids, which is a tachinid fly, which can attack as early as the very first instar, but the larvae are coenobionts, so they parasitoids, so they require almost the entire duration of the caterpillar development in order for the fly larvae to actually develop, and then they emerge very late in late instars of the adults. And when I mapped tachinid parasitism onto this tree, just sort of lumping everything, what we saw is the basal group was hammered by the tachinids. About 50% of them were parasitized. The spiny group was about twice as much as the non-spiny clade. And interestingly, within the spiny clade, the two less defended ones had the lowest levels of attack by this tachinid parasitoid. So we wanted to, since we were lumping across all the different host plants, we wanted to see if this pattern held for individual host plants as well. So we broke it down and looked at spiny versus non-spiny caterpillars in this group and their attack by tachinids. And what we found was the same pattern, that spiny caterpillars tended to be hit a lot more frequently by the tachinids than the cryptic ones in the same pattern. So that was on beech and red oak. So one suggestion that came out of this is, it possible, since these coenobionic parasitoids require their hosts to survive for a long time, could they be actually seeking out physically defended hosts in which to place their young to give them a measure of protection against being eaten in conjunction with their hosts by generalist predators? And so we tested this past summer. One of my undergraduates was really interested in this question, and so we did some predator arena trials where we looked at both assassin bugs and green lacewing nymphs, and they were given choices between spiny and non-spiny larvae that were matched for size to see how they would respond to these physical defenses. And what we found, just as we predicted, is that in these paired trials, that we found generalist predators much preferred the undefended caterpillars for food items. And even comparing spiny versus less spiny, we found a very strong aversion to the Acaria caterpillars, these ones down here, than Euclea, which is a little bit less defended. And so there was pretty strong indication that if in fact they are seeking out physically defended hosts, at least against these predators, those hosts are likely to be less eaten. So this sort of brings up this whole issue of larval crypsis and aposematism, and trying to understand the relationship between morphology and diet breadth. So one prediction we can make is that brightly colored defended larvae might be less constrained in their host use, because that physical appearance of aposematism may work against a variety of host plant backgrounds. So that's the kind of thing we'd like to map onto the phylogeny with a broader phylogeny, try and understand where crypsis and aposematism differ and what the consequences are for radiations of herbivorous insect. So it may be that cryptic species are under selection to become more specialized, or we predict they'd be under selection to become more specialized due to background matching. And then we could analyze this by actually comparing the variation in performance in the presence and absence of enemies among host plants for the two groups, and we're in the process of doing that. We also want to examine the relationship between herbivore morphology and defensive strategy and patterns of diversification, and we're going to continue trials with these generalist predators. So The Lima Code is also, some of the groups are actually gregarious. So most of them are solitary, but there's a few groups like Acaria that tend to be rather gregarious. And so some of this interesting social behavior in these caterpillars needs to be explored, and what role it plays in herbivore diversification as well. And Dan and Winnie have an amazing data set of limacodids that they've been collecting since 1978 at the ACG. And if we look at the limacodids in Costa Rica, it is exactly the opposite of the pattern we see for many insect herbivores, where there's a pattern of increasing specialization from the temperate to the tropics. Here, the limacodids are amazingly prolificous in their dry forests. So I put the line in again for the three host plant families. So these are a bunch of taxa, either genera or individual species, in which case they're monotypic genera. Just looking at the average number of host plant families they've been collected from, many of these taxa are feeding on routinely on 20 families of plants, which is really incredible. So this needs, I think, a lot of attention and explanation to understand what is actually driving diet evolution in these kinds of groups. And we haven't really just scratched the surface to try and look at those kinds of questions. And there's two groups in there, Venetocodia canetti and Epipyrola vaffarella, that are specialized within this group of super prolificous things. One is a fern feeding group, and the other feeds on Lauraceae. So it's interesting to, I don't know what's going on there. I'm sure Dan has some insights, but I think comparing these kinds of groups within a phylogenetic framework is where we really need to go. So my final thoughts are that adaptive radiations of insect herbivores are most appropriately viewed through a multitrophic lens. These tritrophic interactions in particular can drive an array of herbivore adaptations and can either promote or constrain patterns of diversification. Adding a third trophic level means there are many more ecological opportunities available for exploitation by these insect herbivores. It can be very fluid. We can imagine the herbivores moving through space, exploring alternative host plants, and enemies tracking and following them. But ultimately, those interactions are what are driving sort of the amount of space that these herbivores are actually occupying in terms of their tritrophic niches. We need to examine the ecological interactions within a phylogenetic context, and of course this requires collaborations between systematists and ecologists, and in particular a real need for species level or even lower phylogenies is needed, so we can really start to map a lot of these really interesting ecological interactions onto these phylogenies. So with that, I'd like to stop and take any questions. Yeah, I mean, for a lot of specialist parasitoids, they often use host plant volatiles and cues in order to facilitate host location. So it could be sort of a moving target where, and as I saw in a recent talk, a lot of these parasitoids are even capable of learning. So where they're finding hosts may determine where they're going to look for hosts. And so the relative abundance, it could be sort of a frequency-dependent thing where it's moving in time and space, and that may be even promoting some of this diversification. So we really don't know. I mean, most of these specialist parasitoids are finding the hosts they're finding their caterpillar hosts on an array of host plants. So and they have very different chemistries. So it's really hard to imagine that there's a unified cue that's linking, you know, all these different host plants. So, you know, I don't know. Yeah. Yeah, so the data from Hawkins suggests that concealed feeders get nailed very highly. So especially leaf miners have some of the highest parasitism rates. And because they're somewhat advertising their location, they're kind of constrained in their ability to escape. So all of these guys that we're working on are exposed feeders, but they have a lot of adaptations that sort of could inhibit their detection by a lot of generalist predators. So I think it could be a lot of trade-offs between, say, parasitoids, which are really good at attacking concealed feeders, and generalist predators, which may be deterred or not able to even locate these concealed feeders. So, you know, you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. Somebody's going to get you everywhere. That's pretty much my experience. So.
Okay, we're going to have to move on. I want to thank John again for excellent.